Good afternoon. I'm Jerry Waldron, and this is the panel titled Provocatively, I Hope Enough for Everyone. Did the Internet kill the Telecom Act? The premise of this question is that Internet technology was not contemplated when the Telecom Act was written. And as a result, those statutory provisions were written for an analog world and are not applicable and do not work in today's IP environment. One of the jobs I hope we covered this afternoon is to test that hypothesis. And we have a panel who, when I looked down, the only name I didn't recognize was my own. It's a distinguished group that has been around for a long time. Many of them, in various incarnations, were involved in the writing of the 96 Act. And so we're able to explore and hear from them their perspectives on one, you know, how relevant was the Internet to the writing of the Telecommunications Act? And frankly, and I think more interestingly, how much does that matter, whether the Telecom Act was written with that in mind or not? Laws obviously have to change in a dynamic environment, and every law can't anticipate every technology. On the other hand, at various times, some technologies come along which are transformative, and the laws are simply found to be inapplicable. So that obviously is the tension as you are drafting laws. Before turning to the panel members for some brief opening comments, and then it's going to follow by questions by myself, and then open up to the audience. And please do not hesitate to raise your hand as we're going along if you have a question. I want to focus on some of the open issues facing the courts, the FCC, and therefore also facing Congress. And these are the questions which really expose some of the fault lines in our current communications laws, and which have led some to say that Congress needs to step in and rewrite or reopen the Telecom Act because the Internet is this transformative technology. First, what is VoIP, Voice over the Internet Protocol? Is it a telecommunications service which the states can regulate and which is subject to the panoply of common carrier regulation, or is it an information service? And states are told, can't touch this. What about cable modem service? The FCC reached one conclusion, that it was an information service. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit reached a different conclusion. That question is now before the Supreme Court, and it, in the Brand X case, and it poses the same question. What kind of service is it? Is it something that the states or the FCC can regulate either under Title II or Title VI, or is it something that's all bounds to the states and really outside of many common carrier and even cable act regulations, and it's just a pure information service? And a new question, which, you know, frankly, if we had this panel a year or so ago, it might not have been on the agenda. It is today because of activities of some of the telephone companies, including SBC. What is Internet-based delivery of video service? Is it a telecom service? Is it a cable service? Is it an information service? Who gets to regulate it? Is the IP technology destroying these categories that the 1996 Act and that the Communications Act built up? And so therefore, in that sense, is the technology making, if not killing, making meaningless some of the categories and buckets that the 96 Act created? All these questions are now before the courts and the FCC and the Congress. So it is clear that there is uncertainty on these key definitional issues. And as I said, is the conclusion to be drawn from that Congress failed in doing its job and so therefore needs to come in and rewrite the 96 Act? Or is this simply an inevitable byproduct of a dynamic industry and laws are always needing to adapt and change, and indeed that is some of the theme of looking back at the Communications Act. And so therefore now, the FCC has the tools in its kit in order to deal with these issues. The courts have enough guidance and let the system play out. That's one of the tensions in this debate. Let's now turn to the panelists to allow them to give us 3 to 4 minutes of an overview of from their different perspectives on the industry. And let me just sort of quickly run down the panel, introduce themselves. Dan Brenner is the General Counsel of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association and has been a longtime advocate for the cable industry across the range of cable, media, and telecommunications issues. Link Howering is with Verizon and focuses on internet policy for Verizon, and through that participates in lots of different policy discussions across a range of issues on behalf of his company. Peter Pitch is with Intel and has a long career in various parts of the communications industry, both at the FCC and in the private sector, and really has spearheaded the high-tech community's effort on behalf of broadband issues before the Federal Communications Commission and in Congress. And Rick Witt works for MCI and has been a longtime advocate, sort of helping people think through the different layers and platforms that are behind the internet and how people can approach this multidisciplinary topic with the various technology focus. So with that as a preview, let's turn to, and we'll start with Dan Brenner to allow him go, and then why don't we just go right down the line.
Thanks, Jerry, and welcome everybody. I'll try to be brief, just make a few observations on the question that the panel title poses. And Jerry said that he thought that the Act was written for, it's been argued that the Act was written for an analog world, and I think the Act really was written for a litigation world. It was an Act where many of the most complicated issues, starting from jurisdiction and heading straight down the list, were left to the Commission and the courts to decide. One simply has to look at Sections 251 and 252, read them and say, now, what were the states supposed to do and what was the federal government supposed to do? And the Supreme Court and the intervening appellate court before it got to the Supreme Court in the Iowa case came to very different conclusions about what the statute said. And we're left with a federal, and I don't agree with a national or federal approach to the questions in the Act, by Justice Scalia's determination that a 1938 amendment to the Communications Act explained everything, a position that none of the parties, having studied this issue exhaustively, ever took, or didn't take with any great weight to it. So the Act itself is a sea of ambiguity that's been shaped and sculpted by these decisions. Has it been, did the Internet kill the Act? Did the Act kill the Internet? Well, no. I think in many ways, the rule of Washington regulation applied very well to the Act. It's the old rule from the medical community, first do no harm. I think the Act did very little harm to the Internet. It permitted the Internet to develop in ways without a lot of government regulation, and that may be a good thing, may have been a very good thing. I know in the cable industry, through the insight of the FCC in not regulating the cable modem service in terms of forced access or any kind of access requirement up to now, it permitted the cable industry to invest $95 billion and build cable modem residential service so that well over 90% of the country has access to broadband service from a provider other than the phone company. And it also spurred the phone companies to get their DSL service out to the public as well. So in that sense, one of the real goals of any policy, which is to make a service available at a reasonable cost, has been very spectacularly accomplished. The take rates are not to the satisfaction of everybody who likes to make comparisons with Korea, but putting aside the shortcomings of that analysis, which there are some, let's just say that people really have a chance to get it if they want to spend the money for it. It's not a lack of deployment. The final point I'd make is that what we're seeing in this policy debate and what the Act anticipated was this vigorous debate between CLEX and ILEX. Much of the litigation of the 96 Act was a fight about how new entrants would get in, and we spent a great deal of effort trying to decide what those rules of road entry would be for competitive phone companies, which kind of came to a crescendo, we think, last Friday with the last, maybe the last version of these entry rules. And of course we know that what was maybe a four-lane highway for new entrants has been narrowed for CLEX to a much narrower highway. And I think we're into maybe the next phase of it, which Rick Witt has written about, and which is the difference between facilities and non-facilities providers. Should the people like the phone companies, incumbent phone companies and cable companies and wireless companies that have invested money in infrastructure have additional obligations owing to people who haven't done those investments and made investments in software and placed their bets elsewhere in the information economy. That's the debate about access. That's the debate about layering. It's really a question of whether or not communication policy will be directed in that way.
Thank you, Dan. Blake?
The telephone sector has tended to be one driven by acronyms, and unfortunately our acronyms tend to be ones that are not very marketable and our mouths will full. So you hear things like ISDN and DSL, which frankly aren't great for marketing. But one of the ones that people heard about and used for years is POTS, plain old telephone service. And at the time of the 1996 Act, that's what POTS meant. Today, I think POTS means something else. And my daughter uses instant messaging obsessively, and it means parent over the shoulder. And if you want to know how things have changed, that's a good example. It really has changed dramatically because people now are using instant messaging, email, wireless, and other kinds of communications modalities as a substitute for voice and as a way to communicate. So they have a lot of options they never had before. They also had, as Dan said, more options because there are now more networks out there deployed and more capabilities on those networks. So you do have cable modems that can do things, including today, voice increasingly. You do have services on wireless that include video. Verizon now has a service, our EVDO service, which is a service called VCast. It's a movie service on your cell phone, and it's basically video. So you're seeing it in a lot of areas. Convergence is real. And the speaker at lunch was talking about that. I agree with that. It's happened. Did that undermine the Act's premises? And I think one of the major premises of the Act was, as Dan said, the physical interconnection process. How to make sure that physical networks, which were in those days largely circuit-switched and not packet-driven as they are today, and internet-based networks, how do they interconnect? So a lot of the debate was on that. And I believe as investments have occurred and as people have begun to develop applications that ride on these broadband networks that don't need physical interconnections, you're seeing that whole debate shift now towards, as Dan said, what are the issues about openness? How does the internet work? Is it going to have a capability for companies to be able to offer private services, but at the same time ensure that consumers can use the internet, despite the fact that a company like Verizon may offer its own private or proprietary services? They can go where they want to on the internet. Is there a way to make sure that both of those can coexist? And I think it's important they can coexist, because if you can ensure openness so the consumer can go where they want to with their broadband connection, browse where they want to, connect whatever device they want to, can run any application on a broadband connection, but at the same time, Verizon can offer value-added services competitively. So we have innovations and ways to incentives that we can actually drive our network investments. I think those two need to coincide, and we need to be able to ensure that somehow. So that's one of the key debates, I think, going forward. What kind of policies does that suggest? Well, one is that it does suggest, I think, we need to focus on what is going to be the policy of the country towards broadband networks. And that the Act itself did not really do a very good job of that. It really was, in that sense, mostly focused more on the analog world. And we believe going forward we need to look at these new networks. Verizon is developing and investing in fiber networks today, multi-megabit networks that are very expensive to deploy, that have a lot of capability for consumers in both directions, multi-megabit, not just video in, but a lot the other direction, and they are very risky investments. You've got companies out there already that have made the investments. You've got wireless companies increasingly putting their own video and high capacity on their networks. So we've got to have, we believe, a policy that says we don't want the encroachments of the old regulations on these new technologies. The electric industry.
Thanks for the signal, by the way.
I didn't mention the electric industry. I'm sorry. And so that's one issue. The other two issues that quickly mentioned is that in our deployment, we're also talking, as I said, about convergence. So we're offering voice and we're offering high-speed internet service, but we're also going to be increasingly offering video. So we believe there are issues that are, again, part of the old regimes, the old policies that do discourage investment. And one of them, we believe, is this franchising process. We need to look at that and find ways to encourage faster entry, because video is going to be an important part of the way we compete with cable and other companies. So we think we need to look at that. And finally, I mentioned the openness issues. I do believe the issues of making sure that we have principles that ensure companies who have broadband connections, do let consumers go and browse the internet using the broadband connection freely, and have assurance that will happen. I don't think there's any danger it won't, but I understand why people are concerned about that. We need to look at that issue, too, as we go forward.
Thanks, Eli.
Peter?
Okay, great. Thanks, Jerry.
Did the Internet kill the Telecom Act? No, it was Professor Plum in the study with a revolver. Initially, my reaction to the question was to be flip, because while I'm tempted to say yes, full stop, I think that would be equally flip. Intel's vision, dream vision, would be there will be multiple pipes to customers at all times, and everything will run over IP. So, you know, coming from that perspective, I'm tempted to say yes. It clearly had an important effect in creating pressure on the existing regulatory structure, no question. But like many single theories of history, it's too facile and doesn't capture some other important components. I'd say the real pressure is a combination of technology writ large plus policy plus good old business risk-taking. If you think about technology, it's not just the Internet, it's the developments in microprocessors and fiber optics and compression and storage and so on. And that meant not only the Internet, but cheap computers and even better cell phones and so on and so forth. So the technological revolution is much broader than the Internet. But what I'd like to emphasize is it's also a function of policy decisions. And I'd say, in the end, largely right policy decisions. I agree with Dan. Things could have been done better, clearly with 2020 hindsight, a lot better. But at the end of the day, the country resisted the temptation to impose open access on cable companies. It has restored the risk-reward balance for unbundling by the telephone companies. By that I mean those companies are no longer required to unbundle their new broadband investment in the last mile. I think both of these folks would tell you that this investment is risky, expensive, and discretionary, and they did a lot of it, and hopefully now the telephone companies will do a lot more of it. And getting those policies right, I think, has a lot to do with making the transport on which the Internet relies and works a lot better. And that increasingly is putting pressure on the existing regulatory structure. Similarly, policymakers resisted the temptation to regulate voice over IP. This is a revolution that was supposed to happen again and again. Now it looks like it's really going to happen. There are a lot of positive signs. The one I would point to is Comcast's announcement that they're going to start offering voice over IP to 40 million customers within a relatively short period of time. That kind of bundling by the cable companies is clearly going to put a lot more pressure on the telephone companies to do more video so they can have a bundle of their own. Spectrum decisions have been enormously important in freeing up wireless opportunities, and wireless has been a big part of the pressure, the change that we've seen in this marketplace over the last few years. Now, let me just say one thing about the policy part. There's a lot more that could be done, I think will be many important decisions the FCC and the Hill will make in this area. Lastly, I want to just lay down a marker for business risk-taking. A lot of companies, not just high-tech companies, the companies that I know well from Silicon Valley, but other companies have been investing billions of dollars. The cellular industry, clearly, huge investments. The cable industry, I think it's like $90 billion or so in the last 10 years, Dan. I mean, huge investments. That's very risky stuff. And so I think it's important for us to realize that market forces, competition, good old-fashioned entrepreneurial risk-taking is crucial to what we see happening in the marketplace. Well, that would be a good real answer as well. But I think an even better answer might be that it's not clear that the Telecom Act is really dead. I think there's a lot of pressure on it, and it may be listing badly. But there's a a lot that could be done at the FCC to get things right. Now, depending on how the Supreme Court handles a particular case, there might be more tools in the Commission's toolbox. But regardless, I think the Commission has the ability to deal with universal service, has the ability to deregulate in a largely symmetric way cable and DSL and lots of other things, has the ability to forbear and clean up, which still is, I believe, far too messy and uncertain. The final thing I'll say, and I just got the four-minute harumph there from Jerry, remember what I said about multiple fat pipes with everything running over IP. That's where we want to get. I mean, there are a lot of issues out there that people talk about, but I think that's where the excitement is. That's where, as we think about trying to breathe life into telecom legislation, that's where we should be focused. At the end of the day, Intel doesn't care about telephone DSL or cable modem. We want high-quality, ubiquitous, affordable broadband available to everyone. And if we get, we're not particularly concerned about who does it and how they do it, but that, I think, should be our focus as we go forward.
Okay, Rick.
Thanks. I think it's a bit early to be writing the obituary for the Telecom Act of 96. It certainly, to my mind, represented an interesting and perhaps unprecedented experiment, an attempt to try to have two markets kind of go at each other and adjacently, where one side in particular, the Bell Company side, was both the supplier and the potential competitor. It's hard to know whether if there had been, you know, the sea of ambiguity that Dan mentioned, if that had been cleared up a little bit in terms of writing the statute, if the FCC had perhaps a different implementation scheme, if the states had a different role, if litigation didn't turn out the way it did, who knows where we'd be. But I think the fact at this point is that many of these battles are now yesterday's news. And I would submit that the telecom wars largely are over, and I don't believe anybody's won. I think, you know, that certainly the skirmishes we've had the past couple of years, the Bell companies have won for the most part. But now we enter this new era, the era of the Internet, and particularly IP. I think the notion of did the Internet kill the Telecom Act, it's not so much the Internet. The Internet is, to me, is a market phenomenon. It's the thing that happened back in the mid-90s when this technology was unleashed upon the world in a commercial way, and it kind of invaded the lives of everybody. Certainly everybody in this country and around the world. But the thing behind that really is a revolutionary construct is the Internet Protocol. It's the little piece of software code behind the Internet. And the thing that the IP does that is so fundamentally transformative is that it for the first time severs all of the links that we have assumed, not just the Telecom Act of 96, but the Communications Act of 34. All of the different silos, and I'm sure you all have heard about this over the past year or two, which were assumed, the notion that you have telephone service riding on top of telephone copper plants, and that's by a telephone company, and that's to be regulated under Title II. The same thing for cable services under Title VI, and broadcast, television, and radio, Title III, the wireless regime under Title III as well. All of that presumes certain things, and what IP does is destroy those presumptions. It's really kind of, you talk about creative destruction. IP is, I think, the perfect example of a technology that comes in and overturns everything that we had believed was to be true. No longer are there distinctions between industries in an IP environment or between types of networks. In fact, the notion of a service is even in question. Is Skype a service? I don't know. I don't think so. It looks to me more like a piece of software that allows you to get into a database. There's no really service provider there in the middle to be providing a service. But yet that's the thing that the FCC keeps latching onto is the reason to regulate stuff. So from NCI's perspective, at least, it's time to really take a fundamental relook, not just the Telecom Act of 96, but the Communications Act itself and all of the assumptions, again, behind why we regulate things. We've been out there for the past year talking about the layering concept, the notion of looking at the different layers of the data networks, including the Internet, as the basis for, in our view, largely unregulation of what's there. I think the fundamental principle has to be that all entities have a right to do anything they want to in different layers of the network, whether it's the physical infrastructure, the logical layers, applications, and content. Start from the bottom and then work your way up to the extent that there are certain social goods that need to be applied at certain elements of the layers, if there's certain competitive elements, if there's market power concerns, If there are certain fundamental things like the right to interconnect, which I think is still going to have to exist in some way in the new IP to IP regime. But all these things have to be worked through. I think the FCC will be part of it, but hopefully part of this also will come from the industry. So it's not just another example of kind of command and control coming out of an agency in Washington, but it's hopefully interested parties who realize, again, the telecom war is largely over. Nobody has won a convincing victory, at least in my mind, and it's time to get on with the hard but necessary work of figuring out a new regime going forward for all these different what once were disparate industries. Thanks.
Thank you all, and Rick, thank you especially for your brevity and sort of getting us back on back on track here. I'm going to pose some questions, and I invite people to step in, and if you have a question, just sort of raise your hand. It's a small enough audience, I think, we can hear everybody. I don't know whether the panel noticed, but if you look at the brochure describing our panel here, one of the questions or one of the statements in it is, I will admit something that I did not write. I don't think anyone on the panel wrote, so we can quickly disown it or embrace it. But regulatory uncertainty and litigation resulting from definitional issues continue to stall investment and innovation. Let's turn to the panel and say, agree or disagree with the with that statement. And Dan, we'll start with you and go down.
I think for the cable industry, I'd largely disagree. I think we've had regulatory certainty. One of the advantages of the 96 Act was to provide some relief on upper tier pricing of cable services. And while you know things can change as a result of the Brand X case, or something, I think the FCC has been very mindful of the importance of regulatory certainty, as have the relevant committees in Congress.
Blake?
There was, as I think Dan said earlier, there certainly was a lot of ambiguity in the way the law was written, so that the FCC had a lot of responsibility to try to help sort that out with the industry and other players who were involved in the comments process as rules were adopted. I remember when the Act got passed, we sat down with some of our regulatory people, and there were 20 major proceedings within, I think, a year after the Act was put in place. So clearly there was a lot of uncertainty with all those rules coming down the pike. Some of the rules that came out were literally 1,000 pages almost in length. So for the first several years, it created a lot of uncertainty, and I think that continued as companies kept trying to figure out, where were the edges of this? Where do I have to do this, or do I have to do that? So it did create a lot of uncertainty, and that did affect investment. And when we finally got more clarity as to what was supposed to be unbundled and what was not, with respect to broadband in particular, you began to see companies now committing substantial resources to deployment. We now have almost $1 billion we put in the ground so far in the fiber deployment we're involved in. There are 12 states we're actively deploying the technology in. I think around 100,000 customers right now is what we've got in just a few months of actually having operations going in a few states. I think Texas is the main one right now. So that all was done, I think, largely because the certainty was removed in that particular instance. So I think it has a big impact. It has a lot of impact, too, in terms of your strategy going forward as to what it is you want to invest in. So that's why I'm talking. I think it's clear and important for the Congress to focus this year on trying to set out a national policy as to what the broadband policy of the country will be. And I think it ought to be basically a new network should not be.
I'm going to come back to that. But,
okay.
Peter?
Uncertainty is bad, but bad regulations are worse. So given the choice, I'd rather have the uncertainty and even asymmetry, given the way the political process works. I think we've had bad effects from uncertainty, but I think getting the unbundling rules wrong the first time was far more consequential.
I'll give the classic cop-out answer of it depends. On the uni side, I would submit contrary to what Peter said, the uncertainty there actually hurt both sides. It hurt the ILECs, but also the CLECs as well. So I don't think it was anything that was an either-or proposition in that case. But in other cases, regulatory uncertainty actually can be almost irrelevant, because in the things like the VOIP market, or what I like to call EOIP, which is everything over IP, most folks in that industry, the folks kind of on the edge of the network who are putting together all the new exciting fun stuff, they don't care what goes on in Washington. I mean, they're just going to do their stuff, and they'll only care if somebody tells them they can't ride on the network anymore, or they're going to, you know, post some kind of requirement on them. But you know, regulatory arbitrage always is a dirty word to the incumbent or the one who's adversely affected by the arbitrage. To everybody else, it just simply shows that the current system is uneconomic and needs to be fixed. So when you're looking at intercarrier comp, universal service, all the way down the list, over and over again, existing requirements, whether they're ambiguous or not, are being challenged by technology. And that kind of arbitrage, I think, is a good thing because it's kind of the pain that shows you it's time for policymakers to step in and do something rational with the situation.
Well, listening to our panel, I'm not surprised at their answers, but I was sort of going to follow up with a question that maybe our panel title should have been, you know, is the Telecom Act killing the Internet? And I think that's probably, you know, that would be a nice provocative panel and may have sort of gotten people focusing on it. But that is a little bit of what that sentence says. Regulatory uncertainty is stalling investment, and that's stalling, or at least that's the argument, that regulatory uncertainty stalls investment, and stalling investment means that there's not as much broadband out there being used, deployed, et cetera. Let's follow up on the point that Link made. Does Congress need to pass a bill to enable your company to achieve its goals on the Internet? And Link, since you raised the question, you get to take a first whack at it.
I think it's important to establish a policy. I outlined three of the major issues that we have been concerned about. One is the way that new networks are treated in terms of any unbundling or economic regulatory requirements. Second is entry issues, and one of them we have been saying is franchising. We are negotiating franchises now to get into video. The fact is we already have telephone networks that we are essentially upgrading for fiber, and we have essentially franchises or approval that we've had for years to offer telephone service, and in all the cases we put the fiber out, we're automatically doing high-speed internet and telephone service, but we have to still get a franchise to do the video piece of it. So we think that's an entry barrier, in part because today, as it was mentioned earlier, competition is not just about offering one service or another service. It's being able to, as a network provider, with the capabilities we've got, to have a range of services, because people expect that. So we do need to have video as part of that model, and if it takes months and months and months to get franchises, and there are literally thousands of them you have to get, it makes the entry process extremely difficult. So I think those kinds of issues are ones that Congress should focus on, because I know one of the things they're concerned about is encouraging more investment in this technology so you continue to have more investment and innovation in these networks and more people who can ride these networks and innovate on those networks.
Dan, other than the fact that most of the people in this room need something to do for the next 2 or 4 years, or especially me in private practice, but anyway, yeah. 6 years, you know, does the cable industry need Congress to pay a bill to enable it to achieve its goals?
No, I don't think so. I think that our entry is, at least at this point in the voice, video, and data market, we're in those markets. I think one thing that listening to the other speakers is interesting about whether did the Internet kill the Telecom Act. Now, in many ways, cable's more substantial entry into voice services was enabled by broadband. I think in 1996, a lot of people had hoped that the telcos would get into video and cable companies would get into phone. Some of our cable companies, Cox and at that time AT&T, now Comcast did, and but now we have this new way of offering phone service thanks to broadband that provides customers an additional facilities-based choice. You know, that is, in terms of the 96 Act's aspirations, a home run, because once you get facilities-based competition, you can pull the government out of the synthetic competition that rate determinations or price determinations for elements or for resale requires. So, again, the short answer is I don't think there are always things that could be improved, but by and large, I think cable's able to do it. And I also would admonish those who would go in and, you know, it's a little like foot surgery, right? I mean, sometimes when you hurt your foot, the doctor will say, well, you may be better off not operating and just leaving what happened, because you go in and try and fix a bone in the foot, and you may do more harm than good. We have seen the challenges in 1994 through 1996 in trying to pass a comprehensive piece of legislation. And those challenges are formidable. And to go back to your opening comment there, I don't think that the communications bar or the lobbying world has shrunk since those years. In fact, there are more people with more stakes and more agendas in communications than there were 9 years ago. So I think it would be even more difficult for conscientious legislators to get all the facts that they need to come to an absolutely clear idea of exactly the right new sets of words that would not engender the litigation that we saw under the old Act.
Rick, how about from MCI's perspective?
Our answer is yes. I think there is a need for Congress to step in. There are some things the FCC can do, and they have done to some success at least. But ultimately, I think it's going to require actually passage of a statute that the FCC then can implement with full authority. There really are roughly two categories of things that we think need to be rectified. One is, what do you do with broadband networks? And the second is, what do you do with IP-enabled applications like VoIP? In both cases, the existing statute doesn't really fit very well onto those two constructs, and yet that's the kind of world we're evolving into. It's going to be the world of the physical broadband networks. Right now, we only have two. We hope there'll be more in the future. And then second, everything else that rides on top of it. All the everything over IP, not just voice, but all the other applications that are be coming down on us over the next few years. That regime also is, I think, a big muddle. And our fear is that regulators looking for something to do in this new environment may overreach and attempt to impose requirements where they're not necessary in what should be a robustly competitive environment. So we need to have some sort of a national dialogue on what to do with broadband. Is there a need for, in the case if there's market power, is there a need for some sort of non-discrimination safeguards, either on the end user side or ISP side or both? And in the meantime, we have to also encourage alternative modalities, more spectrum available for unlicensed use, for example, broadband over power line, et cetera, and then what to do in the IP environment to try to keep that as unregulated as possible.
Peter, you mentioned earlier that maybe the FCC has the authority to deal with universal service and some of the other issues. Do you think that Congress needs to step in to help Intel achieve its goals?
First, I want to remark on Dan's knowledge of podiatry. I thought that was very impressive.
He's a foot picker from that.
I happen to be an expert on non-occlusive footwear, too.
Well, my answer is that ideally these issues would be dealt with by Congress. There are some things, Link mentioned a few, that only they could deal with, and frankly, it would be better if Congress addressed these issues clearly. I think there are important issues on broadband and there are IP-enabled services, universal service, and spectrum. I would say that we should not be naive about this. I mean, the Telecom Act ended up where it ended up for good reasons, and there are lots of pressures pushing Congress in many directions, and the ambiguities were there not through lack of understanding, but as ways of forming compromises. So we should realize that legislation may have its limits again unless there is a deeper consensus this time around. I would still say that the FCC has a lot of authority to do things here, regardless of how the Brand X case comes out. And I think we should put a lot of pressure on the FCC to continue to move things in the right direction.
I will say, as somebody who's been on sort of both sides of the legislative process, to underscore Peter's point that it's not that the members of Congress and their staff are not smart enough to realize that there is ambiguity in this, or that it might not be as crisp, or gee, there's going to be a lawsuit that's going to seek to define what this means. Getting to yes is a very hard process, and everyone uses the sort of ink blot analogy that sometimes, you know, you can get to yes and you can deal with 60, 70, 80, 90% of the questions. And if you really have to wrestle down to the 100% degree, you'll never get done.
Jerry, can I make a point of that, though? At the time of the Telecom Act passed, though, just to give an example of how some of these ambiguities and confusions actually do enter into people's minds, the industry itself, the telecom sector that I'm in, the local telecom companies, were actively pushing this legislation. And when the legislation passed, a couple of days later, one of our senior executives issued a statement saying that we were going to be in long distance in 5 days in 5 states. And he actually believed that. And a lot of folks in the company thought, this checklist process for long-distance entry is pretty simple and straightforward. Well, obviously, it turned out after time because of the definitions of the SEC and, frankly, the industry in squabbling.
Was this all with the Securities and Exchange
There was confusion.
He was misquoted. He said it's going to be a long distance till we get into long distance.
I have the press release because it's just a classic. But, I mean, there was a lot of confusion.
Thank you. I was making it up.
I know you have
a press release. They will now file an ex parte at the commission. Secretary, what's your name?
I believe was a little ambitious. But you know, people saw and then, you know, and the Bells, you know, endorsed the bill and then filed a lawsuit against it a week later. So, yeah, there was that. I can resist that chief judge.
I remember that.
SEC in Texas.
Right.
So, anyway.
Bill of attainder.
But I do want to understand that.
I think it violated the slavery clause at one point in the litigation.
That it does, and the takings clause, so that's always the thing.
That was it.
Anyway, but it does sort of underscore that it's harder to get it, you know, my version is right, their version is ambiguous. That's how everybody gets into the game, and guess what, you know, it's always a little more complicated than that. I see a question before I... Yes, sir.
I'm Stephen, I'm a fellow in Senator Burns' office. Another agency is over at State Department, just a broad conceptual question, which the idea of going to a sort of a layered model where you regulate, you define a service, you know, voice, video, data, whatever, and you'd regulate it the same way regardless of whatever you're talking about. It seems pretty well suited to the IP world, you know, so whether it's VoIP, whether it's cable, whether it's telephony, it'd be the same way as a voice.
silo regime lacks. I mean, and one of the problems, you know, I come out and talk about layering, and then usually, you know, one of my good colleagues here from the cable side or Bell side immediately jump on us because, you know, we've asked questions about whether there should be, you know, open access requirements or net neutrality or something at the physical layer. You know, layering doesn't take you there. Layering just enables you to ask the right kinds of questions. It doesn't take you to an inevitable conclusion. So I think one can probably argue about, you know, market power analysis and HHI standards and the like, and are there needs for safeguards? Is the four freedoms that Chairman Powell's talked about sufficient? That's all fine, and that's all the kind of debate to have. But I hate to see layering kind of tagged, as I think Dan actually did earlier on, as this thing that is an attempt to try to get the physical infrastructure guys regulated, because it really, that's not the intention. The intention is that let's start from zero, figure out what do we need to regulate, what we don't need to regulate, and treat everybody the same. As you mentioned, you know, the notion of voice service, cable service, video service has become meaningless in a number of years. So let's get there before we get into this huge mess of trying to use the old definitions in these to try to address these new regimes. And by the way, I have copies of a deck in the back that goes through layering in a little more detail if anybody wants to pick it up, because I didn't want to burden the opening comments with it. But anyway, I think it's one well worth Congress at least well worth taking a look at.
Anyone else want to take a shot at that?
I promise I was not going to mention layers.
Well, the question brought it up, Link, in terms of the sequence. The cons are, I mean, as an analytical tool, you know, a way of thinking about things, just, you know, from a 20,000 foot, it has some real academic virtue. But the problem with it as any kind of a tool for policymaking is that the idea of layers is that you try to restrict the layer at the transport layer to transport. And what we have from the get-go in cable has been an integrated content conduit pipe. What we have in a company like Microsoft are applications riding on top of operating systems. What we've had really, what Time Warner is as a company, one of the platinum sponsors here, is a company that integrates conduit content in a variety of interesting ways that produces a lot of good in society. So the problem is that once you try to use it as a compass for policy, it leads you to restrictions that don't really make sense either in the real world or even in a projected world, because there are many times that you want the transport layer to be integrated with other functions. What was pointed out by Rick is, well, you want to be careful so that that transport layer allows for many other positive goals in society. And as we've seen up until now, people can get anywhere they want on the internet, whether they go on a narrow band, a broadband, or a wireless or a satellite platform. Any of those work. And people can get where they want to go without restriction. So it seems to me once you try to set rules that restrict interlayer ownership, you run against the free enterprise system.
The model actually is a very useful one, because it's one that actually was used to build the internet, the ISO engineering models or layered models. And the reason it was designed that way is in large part so that the various components of the internet's packet handling systems did not interfere with each other. So you had smooth transport back and forth, didn't have to worry at this layer at the very top having to make them sync up, because what they did up here did not affect at all the transport piece. So it was a beautiful system from that standpoint. The fact is that your packets have to go all the way from the infrastructure in your computer over the lines all the way up to the browser and back, right? I mean, to the website and back. And there are people and companies involved in each of those stages. Theoretically, packets could be interfered with at any of those stages. There have been cases at the applications layer, for example, and I'm not going to name the company that makes the operating system, but it was a company that makes an operating system. Was it intentional? I don't know. But it was cleared up. I mean, in fact, what happened was there were concerns raised about it. Some of the browsers didn't work with the operating system. Complaints, next thing you know, got cleared up. So the point is, the MCI proposal is a useful model, but what it does is takes the leap and says, here's the layers, and the bottom layer is anti-competitive. It needs to be regulated. Everything else is fine. If Rick was actually being honest about what they're trying to do, then we had to be taking a look at the whole thing and saying, are there market power problems anywhere in these layers? I don't think you can prove there's market problems at the physical infrastructure level, but you know, somebody might be able to make a case there is at some other level too. Do you want to regulate applications? I don't think so. So I think that's where it breaks down.
Just briefly, the public policy question here is, fundamentally, does any one of the firms or anyone, any relevant market have a market power problem. And the layering model is tempting in that regard because it does suggest some horizontal market analysis. However, I think as policymakers look at this, it would be better just to frame it, the question, in an antitrust standpoint. Look at the relevant market, ask if there are choices, do the firms in the marketplace in that relevant market have market power, is there entry, so on and so forth, and then make the analysis based on that kind of analysis.
To take this sort of the layer approach as perhaps a new paradigm, or at least a contender, as Dan said, as a construct to looking at the issue, it may lead people in different directions, as you just heard here, what policy conclusions to take from that. Do we need a new regulatory paradigm that is either a new silo or a cross-cutting silo? And I feel like this is a little bit of a back to the future exercise for I think everybody at this table who is old enough to at least smile a little when you hear Title VII. Al Gore, who invented both the Internet and Title VII of the Communications Act, had this big idea in 1993 that there should be a Title VII. What he didn't understand is there already is a Title VII, but that's a topic for another day. But anyway, and that this Title VII would be where all new things would go. He didn't use IP back then, but sort of all new. And a bit is a bit is a bit was his saying. And so there would be a Title VII regulatory scheme. And some all new services would belong in this Title VII. Was that an idea that was, well, many of us thought of sort of should not have gone very far, it didn't go very far in 1993, but is that an idea that was 10, 12 years ahead of its time, and Al Gore is off the scene, but and maybe, God forbid, we will never call it Title VII, but is that scheme that there should be a new regulatory classification, that everything IP-based should fall into this bucket, and this bucket should have relatively light, but maybe some basic regulatory requirements? Peter Martin, we'll start with you on that.
Oh, dear. I was waiting to hear what others were going to say.
I sense the fear.
Yeah. Good. That's good. I think that Congress would be better advised to focus in on narrower issues. How is broadband regulated, universal service, IP-enabled services? Now, that's sort of cheating because, I mean, you could solve this problem or part of the problem by creating a Title VII, but my instinct is I would need to do a lot of due diligence before I would want to go down that route. I'm not sure that it might create more problems for you politically and a policy standpoint. There's an obvious appeal to it, but I can see lots of thorny questions. So I'm afraid I'm going to give you that rather weak answer.
Dan, how about you?
I think Peter expressed it very well. The only thing I'd add is that, having said that the Title VII poses new and additional type problems, there are challenges before the Commission in terms of things like Title I versus Title II on VoIP, and I think that, in many ways these issues are not stymieing the marketplace. If VoIP providers listed the three issues that they need to get done to provide business, and probably number one is interconnection and making sure that's good, whatever it takes to get that part of the puzzle solved, and then address the other important social concerns of telephone service, which is primarily universal service, and then some other social, an array of social issues. Once most of those get solved, 95% of the regulatory issues get solved, and hopefully the Commission can be sustained when it solves those problems in the IP-enabled rulemaking. I think that video will happen along just fine if phone companies want to enter it. We welcome competition. We face very stiff competition today from satellite. Cable has about 74% at last count of video homes, so we're hardly the 95 or 90% entity that we were when cable regulation was written anew in 1992. It's a pretty competitive business. We welcome more competition. We understand the reasons why phone companies want to be part of that mix. But I think that their regulatory problems are not the real challenges in that business. They will get through as they are already starting to do the franchising exercise, and I think they can do it. And other overbuilders have done it. It does not seem to be the thing about the thing that is the make or break point in video services. And so do we need a Title VII? Well, if we can get through the major business problems for companies, then we don't need new regulation.
Rick, how about you?
I think Title VIII is available.
There we go.
Check it out the other day. Actually, we think that is a pretty decent idea, and it seems like something of a paradox, right? You create another silo along the other silos, but the notion here is this is the one that eventually the other ones will kind of wither away from lack of use. Over time, IP... whether it's IPv4, IPv6, or any kind of successor protocols, that is the future of all of our collective industries. And so, again, to it just makes sense to us to figure out from scratch what are the things you need. Interconnection in an IP environment, I think, is a fundamental right that all providers should have. How do you kind of define that and put that out there? How do you sustain universal service in that kind of a world? What about carrier compensation schemes? All of that can be dealt with, I think, in its own separate paradigm under a Title VIII or whatever you want to call it, as its own silo. And over time, that's going to be the place that most industries will reside in. One example I like pointing to is the Commission talks about their Title I so-called ancillary jurisdiction over information services. Well, that's not really clear. Looking at the Act, there's an argument to be made that there is no, in fact, jurisdiction over information services by the FCC. And yet, I remember Chairman Powell 3-4 years ago giving a speech where he talked about, isn't it great that we've decided not to regulate your browser? Because, of course, we could. That speech scared the hell out of me because I don't want any agency mucking around in things they shouldn't be mucking around in. So if you create a new title or a new section or something that just says for once and for all IP-based applications, devices, technologies, services, etc., are outside of any regulatory regime of the FCC or the states, period, end stop. And if you've got a small, example, a small exception for something like a commercially viable VOIP product that's taking the place of circuit switch, you need to do CALIA 911, you can do that. But again, you're starting from the bottom and working your way up, as opposed to starting with all this mess we have now and trying to force our way back down. So long and short is, I think a new silo to kind of knock over the other silos may be the best way to go.
Link, and I'm going to ask you to make it a minute.
I think Rick's got a good answer there. A lot of this is the lack of clarity in the Act and the FCC trying to determine how things fit. So when something comes up, they try to seize a Title I, Title VI, and there's not a lot of guidance. And so that's why you end up with a lot of the fights we've had. And so I'm not sure I agree with the Title VII and necessarily creating a separate one, but I think some guidance, and that's why I was talking about a national broadband policy, something that clearly says here's what the Congress thinks is the policy, is important, however you do that.
Any questions from the audience? Yes, sir.
I'm John Schwartz from the Center of Ladies Office. I'm trying to understand the pros and cons of the NCI's regular approach. And my question is whether voice over IP itself is perhaps not an example of how interlayer restrictions would stop innovation after all. What would have happened a lot sooner had TCIP had quality of service built into it? And in the last 5 or 10 years, people have been working hard to try to make up for that deficiency. So if, in fact, you put hard boundaries between these layers, it seems to me that work is a good example of how innovation would be cycled.
Well, and I meant to come back a little bit at some of Dan's and some actually everybody's comments on the proposal. One is you're not restricting anybody to any particular layer, and the divisions between the layers are meant to be a conceptual framework. It's not saying that thou shalt live in the physical world and that's all you can do, or that there are these inseparable boundaries between the two that you should never be breaching. It's rather a way to help you think, I think, more creatively about what's going on in the network. In that case, yes, sir, there are issues with VIP going back many years, the so-called internet telephony, but there are issues beyond that, and the biggest one was broadband. There wasn't really broadband out there in a way that was robust enough to allow people to build in the kinds of security arrangements and the quality of service that you need to provide a really robust VIP offering. So I mean, it's always the classic case looking backwards. I mean, you know, the video phone. How many times have we tried the video phone and it never happened? Well, the market wasn't ready for it. The technology wasn't quite there. But, you know, I think VoIP is something that really, in many ways, was inevitable, just a question of when it was going to happen. And I don't know that a layering approach would have prevented it or kept it from coming any sooner than it did.
Anyone else? Yes, over here.
Yeah, and maybe this gets to the Title VII question. You said that the approach would be to look at each market and examine the market power, then each market. In a converged network IP-enabled world, how do you define a market? I mean, if I'm doing all my communications through iChat AV, is that a voice service or a video service? If I'm downloading movies through real networks, is that an internet information service or a video service? I mean, how do you define a market in that world?
You don't.
I don't think you define markets strictly from the point of view of the consumer. So you, in that case, there are businesses trying to put inputs, and that's why I didn't reject out of hand Rick's idea of layers. There would be it may be that someone would say transport is the relevant market, and therefore we have to consider cable modem and DSL and maybe wireless or whatever, and then people would ask questions about whether or not that is the relevant market. So the fact that consumers might never, they might be buying bundled services, or they might not, they may or may not be buying cable modem on a standalone basis, wouldn't be relevant.
I got a signal actually from my moderator, the Haram. So I'm going to wrap up, but I do want to actually, and I invite people to go up, but I do get to close, and I will sort of take the chair's prerogative to close it. As people are thinking about sort of what our purpose is and what is the 96 Act and how Congress sort of deals with the issues, I put out for your consideration the following guiding principle for a rewrite of the 96 Act. And the purposes of this act include: 3, to make available so far as possible to all the people of the United States, regardless of location or disability, a switch broadband telecommunications network capable of enabling users to originate and receive affordable, high-quality voice, data, graphics, and video telecommunication services. Some people may actually think that's a nice statement. If anybody can tell me where that's from.
Section 706A.
No, actually. It passed the United States House of Representatives on June 7, 1994, as part of H.R. 3636.
Who's going to know that? Be fair. I mean, we're smart people, but give us a break.
Maybe Congress actually thought about the word broadband before 2005. That's the only point that we're
going to point you
Thank you, all panelists.
That's a tough test.
Come on, I wrote that, Dan. Of course I had to pull out the little nugget.
You're